1999 Sunstone Symposium in Salt Lake City presents My Mystical Journey, Session 101, Emma Luthane.
Welcome to this early morning devotional of this year's Symposium of 25 Years of Sunstone. We welcome you here. And admission is by name tag or ticket, and a registration desk is outside. I'm happy to introduce today my friend Emma Luthane, but my guess is that she doesn't need any introduction to any of you who are here. I think we all know they can't hear. I can talk with them. I think it is. Can you? This is better. Okay. All right. I'm happy to introduce my friend Emma Luthane, but I don't think she needs an introduction to any of you who are here. I think we all know of her remarkable accomplishments. We've read her writings, we've heard her speak, and we've sung her hymn, Where Can I Turn for Peace? Emma Lou has held numerous professional positions. She's had dozens of distinguished honors and awards. She's authored 15 books and collections of prose and poetry, and the 16th is coming out soon, and at least one of these has been translated into Russian and German. She's given community and church service, and she gives around 50 speeches and readings and lectures a year. Emma Lou is a world peace advocate, a bridge builder, a friend to many, and she uplifts any of us who are around her. Emma Lou.
That was Beverly Johnson, who didn't introduce herself, but she's my friend. You could probably tell. Last night, I had the interesting occasion to spend an hour on the phone with my scientist brother, Dr. Homer Warner, who spent his lifetime in research in computing heart disease. He said, what are you going to talk about, Lou? And I said, well, let's talk a minute and see. And I tried my best to tell him what I was going to talk about. And he said, I don't understand. I said, well, I guess it would be like you're trying to explain some kind of formula to me, as he used to explain his computers in the old days. But I went to bed a little discouraged, thinking there's no way to explain a mystical journey. And then, as is wont to happen, I woke up this morning with a whole new approach to what I'd like to talk to you about today. Kathleen Norris, in a wonderful book, she's known primarily as a poet, and she's written The Cloister Walk and now a new one called Amazing Grace, A Vocabulary of Faith. In this book, she says, the word mystic is as dangerous as the word poet. She says, when we describe someone as a poet or a mystic, we generally mean it as a warning. And my friends will love this. Here is someone whose head is in the clouds and who can't get places on time. Then she goes on to say that the writers of the early church used the word contemplation to convey their experience of the presence of God. Paul, she says, speaks simply of Christ living in me. Then she continues, I find that I appreciate mysticism best in its most ordinary manifestation, as a means for tapping into the capacity for holiness that exists in us all. I love that. One of the things that I told my brother last night was that the story of the astronaut and the brain surgeon, a Russian astronaut who was not a believer, and said, I've been in the heavens many times. I've been out there in space, and never have I seen a heavenly body or an angel. And the brain surgeon, who was a believer, a Christian, said, I've been inside many brains, and never have I seen an idea or a thought. I think that this illustrates as well as anything can the kind of thing that I've been happy to be part of for some time. I thought that the seeing of heavenly bodies and participating in ideas and thoughts could be explained. But the book that I've just written, called My Mystic Life, Adventures and Connections, deals with a kind of... Oh, thank you. What button do I push? Victor to the rescue. Okay. Earl, when I signal, will you press the green glowing button?
Okay.
Thank you. At any rate, it's been, as I'd say in the foreword to the book, an adventure every minute of the way to try to describe my mystical journey. And since the accident that I had on a freeway now 13 years ago, it's been like a photograph coming up out of the developing fluid, where at first it's very murky and nothing is clear at all, and then gradually an edge appears here and a detail there, and finally after all this time, there are enough details and edges and the possibility of not conclusions but at least arrivals that the book has found itself on a page. I grew up with Mormonism in my veins, continues to be there in everything I do and think and say. People have asked me, do you write as a Mormon? Do you write as a woman? And I think all of that is like smoke and flame. Excuse me. Inseparable. Of course I do. Of course I write with all of that perking inside me. But at the same time, I've described my Mormonism at this point as having all my pillars intact. I've talked at Sunstone about the pillars of my faith. With all the pillars intact, but the roof blown blessedly off the structure to reveal a whole sky full of stars. So faith and stars are what motivate me, what lead me into a day and caress me in the night, when I do what my mother said about pray at night and plan in the morning, which is exactly what I got to do last night. I brought a couple of visual aids just to enhance the idea of what I'm doing. First, to talk about my growing up, a sampler by my great-grandmother that's been on the wall of every home I've lived in. Here's this sampler on what Laurel Ulrich tells me is really quite wonderful linen. But it's signed Emma Turner, age 7 years, September 8th, 1840. 7 years old, and she did this sampler that includes numbers to 14 and then the alphabet. And then this little verse that has lived with me. It says, when daily I kneel down to pray, as I am taught to do, God does not care for what I say unless I feel it too. I love it. I love what that says, because my whole feeling for the mystical now is feeling. And I guess this is what I couldn't explain to my scientific brother, is that I deal in feeling. Years ago when I was telling a story about a little girl in the tabernacle, 8 or 9 years old, sitting there with my father, listening to Helen Keller, as you know, had no way to. I mean, she'd lost her speech, her hearing, as a very young girl. She talked about how she'd come to know that. And then she asked a favor. She said she asked questions of the audience, put her fingers on Annie Sullivan's lips, and got what the question was. Someone asked, do you feel colors? And she said, sometimes I feel blue. But then she asked a favor, and she said in that guttural, slow voice, to ask a favor of you, I would like to hear your song about your pioneers. I would like to remember hearing it here. And so President Grant got up from the front of the room, or the front of the hall, and took her up to the podium, or took her back to the organ from the podium. And she stood there in her long black velvet dress with her hand against the console of the organ that has 5 manuals and 8,000 pipes. And she stood there with her hand outstretched, and Alexander Schreiner played Come, Come, Ye Saints, every verse, each one different. And as she stood there, hearing through her hand, she sobbed. And here's this little girl in the back of the balcony watching this. And I say in the story that whatever came to her through the organ and her hand came to me. The seeing without seeing, the hearing without hearing, the going by feel towards something holy, something that could make her cry, and to lift my scalp right off, something that no matter what would never go away. I believed. What it had to do with Joseph Smith and his vision, I was yet to learn. But I believed, and it has stayed. Years later, I was at a poetry workshop in Florida with 9 poets chosen by William Stafford to get together. William Stafford, the remarkable poet himself, said that he'd been in on many poetry workshops and always you expected to be stimulated intellectually and certainly emotionally, but it was the first one he'd ever been in on to be stimulated spiritually. Each one of us was very different in our backgrounds. We'd go out on the beach. We were there for 3 weeks. We'd go on the beach together at night and look. William Stafford had told us that the comet, Halley's Comet, was going to be visible. We went out on the beach, had 6 pairs of binoculars, looked for the comet up by the Pleiades. And as we looked, everybody scanned the skies, and I took the binoculars, and I'm no good at this sort of thing. I always just see everything's a Milky Way to me. But there in the right next to the place that they said it was to be, there was this darting light. I said, oh, there it is. And everybody listened and tried to look and see, but nobody saw it but me. And they insisted that I change binoculars and try others. And they said, you're jiggling the binoculars. I put my arms on the car. I put them on shoulders. I'd scan, but always there it was. And I'd try to say where. But nobody saw it but me. And I couldn't say I didn't see it, because I did. So we were to write a pantoum about this after, which is a Malaysian form that includes repetition instead of rhyme, but very specifically. And my first one that night at my condo started out, it's called Meditations on the Heavens. The comet is an angel wing. Angel wings are on the beach. I found one shining in the sand one late night looking for the comet. We'd been told would be by Pleiades. Then it continues through 6 stanzas, and at the end it says, an ancient icon like a comet's head approaching sun, an angel wing was on the beach, a celestial body grounded for our view one late night looking for the comet. Then I went to bed, and nighttime feeds me. Invariably it feeds me, and I woke up with another meditation. This time, this says the comet is a darting light. Suppose he really saw the vision, God, the angel. My church owns the story, Joseph in the Grove, 14, a supernatural sight of extraordinary beauty and significance while praying for a truth that had eluded others. My church owns the story, Joseph in the Grove, 14, not unlike Joan, young Buddha, or Muhammad, while praying for a truth that had eluded others. From unusual encounter, the gift more than surprising. Then we skip down 4 stanzas, and this is the last. The meteor, the incandescent sparkler writing names by Pleiades. Suppose he really saw the vision, God, the angel. More than white on black that no one else could see, a supernatural side of extraordinary beauty and significance. And that word, suppose, lived with me. And I thought, what a glorious thing to go through life with, that notion of suppose, of possibility, of wondering. And wondering is so different from doubting. And then, later, I was away writing, and I got another one. The Meditations on the Heaven, Part 3, The Comet is Remembering. Not until today, this small comet in my scalp, the clattering of memory, the painting in the chapel of my childhood against the organ loft, Joseph kneeling at the elevated feet of the Father and the Son. Backdrop to the hymns, the bishop and the sacrament, my quarter century there, it rose indigenous as music. Did the artist put it in, the vision, or did I? My quarter century there, it rose indigenous as music, more real now than Palmyra, where I occupied one grown-up Sunday, the sacred grove. Sun streaming on the boy at prayer, indelible on knowing, like features of a mother giving milk, and then skipping. Indelible unknowing, the comet in my scalp, like the features of a mother giving milk. In the chapel of my childhood against the organ loft, the vision. Then there's a postscript. Later we went to that chapel that I hadn't been in for maybe 20 years. Through the entire hour of the farewell that we were there to attend, I studied the painting, still huge in the nave of my childhood church, Ali Green Richards' beauty. Only the sacred grove was there, now far up behind the pulpit, trees, sunlight, sky, no boy at prayer, no father, son. Had it ever been there, the vision? I didn't ask or want to know. My friends had teased me that night of looking at the comet and saying, "Well, Emmalou, we know you come from a visionary background." Maybe I do. All along, my search, my finding, my supposing has been through the ineffable. I remember looking that word up about 25 years ago when one of my sons-in-law used it in a poem about flying solo. And I thought, none of this has been without the help of that divine power, whose constancy I feel more indebted to than ever in my life. I know now thoroughly that angels abide, miracles happen, prayer is expectation and fulfillment. Here and there are undivided except by our inability to see without seeing. Love is eternal, as is God. We are too. For all of my 64 years and 14, I've been showered with these truths. But only in my growing older and up have I noticed. Maybe because I've found them in the ineffable. I understand what an ineffable is. It's the moment before the coming of a poem. Seeing a baby born. Watching an aspen drop its golden leaves in a wind. The rich smell of their mulch. The song of a stream falling into itself. An aria with flute. The flight of a dancer. It's a wilted plant coming to life with a drink of water. The crescendo of making love. The disappearance of a bruise. It's seeing a vision that was not there in the painting at the Sacred Grove. It was a cord surrounding a table, eyes holding. It's what that region is between sleeping and waking. The ultimate access to how. It's a daughter skiing a flawless slalom, another playing a concerto or creating a stained glass window, any one of them doing what I can't or can. It's the arrival of a friend I just thought about, or the safe return of a dear I just prayed about. It's with the whispering of my mother on the day she died, her talking to someone, not me, as I held her hand and knew she was about to join that someone. It's what happened to me in my death experience and long return now more than 13 years ago. Ineffable. In that experience, I was traveling the freeway with my son-in-law, when this came up through the windshield, burst the windshield and hit me in the face. Of course, things happen. Why? Some random coming through the windshield to hit me. Years later, my Hindu friend in Sun Valley would introduce me to someone else as a someone who had been hit by a spear from the gods. A poem about it. When I still was having, I had just barely gotten my eyesight back. For 7 months, I couldn't read. I couldn't put my head down to jiggle for anything. They put me back together with surgery up through my mouth and down through my, hit me right here. But I had 8 fractures and I'm all screwed to titanium plates, but I'm together. It was a long time before I wrote this poem out of the night. Things happen. Early in the world, you travel into them. One day you rise without prayer in a far camp. We were camping with Mel and our daughter Rinda and her family. And it was her husband, who's a plastic surgeon, who was driving. That's the only way to have an accident like this. You rise without prayer in a far camp and silently hurry away. having slept under stars and still breathing the grade fire, who would take time to suppose this the middle of a lifetime? You whisper kisses to those left flowering, a big hand, a small foot uncovered. You travel the sleepy gullies, come out of the mountains laughing. Because it is morning and you and that sun have places to go, even the heartless freeway is acceptable, having an end. His traveling is dexterous, fast, like you used to ski. You reading to him from the new owner's manual of how. Things happen. A crash like a shot. Your hand full of blood. From temple and eye, the split second. Speed ramming steel into your newly spent lifetime. The blanks of bewildered abruption. Not in on what was before you. Gone the luxury of seeing, of choice. From the highway through the windshield, the splatters of morning. Smashed to floating that side of your face, what it held. Instant the clouds, the passages saying, you hear me? Another place, a distant light, a flower in wind. You echoing, why? Spilled questions wrenching your temple and eye to strenuous focus. A dark navigable by caress and whisper, a stillness. Things happen. As a writer, you imagined yourself inside another, slowly connections emerging from disconnections. Now, through pain, you travel painlessly by a new manual of how. That sun, a surgeon, turns hazard lights on, excuse me, goes 90 to emergency, impossible, patrolmen, doctors, reporters heft the 6-pound shaft. To you, nothing here is immediate, crucial, in the least attractive, looking beyond hours of x-rays, stitches, shots, ice. All that time returning, you vague about familiar hands, tangled in your head the blow to trace, surely someone else's story. Approaching landmarks like on a curve, seeing where you've been, things happen by the light of a new manual of how. After the accident, I was a stranger in my skin. I didn't recognize anything or anyone with any kind of affection or emotion. I didn't cry. I didn't laugh. It was a strange, strange time for me. One morning I woke, and out of the night, here was another out of sleep, strange little verse that fit the rhythm of now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. Only this one said, a wizard lived inside my head, could plan, create, and figure. Never slept except to dream, my sweet companion wizard. Calmed me, resurrected me, gave reason when there was none. Made me believer, celebrator. Wizard, are you gone? By the way, I couldn't read this back. A genie lived within my heart, could fathom joys and woes. Could reach around 1,000 souls and thank with, yes, I knows. Could yearn, embrace, and kiss, and weep. Could soar, take me along. Genie, I'm so alone without your siren song. A tiger lived inside my bones. Could muster, leap, and frolic. Take on jungles, find a way. Was seldom melancholic. Oh, forests, where's my tiger hidden? How deep the dark confoundings. Without you, tiger, in my limbs. Pale, wasted, are their poundings. It was a hard time. I didn't know who I was. I didn't know where I was. I didn't know where I was going, what would happen. And then one night I awoke with another poem that described where I'd been. It surprised me. I found in my journal months later when I could read it back. I was writing all the time, even if I couldn't read. I thought I was vaguely between some lines. It's a disease, this writing, folks. And this is the poem called Having Died Out of the Night, Childness. And this was the only word that I could find to describe the way past bliss or euphoria or ecstasy that experience was for me when I went to the place of knowing. Here it is. More than a state of being, a new being, suffused in light, whatever is there like being held in Father's arms, way beyond safe, carried asleep from one quiet to another, all of it a heartbeat, back, 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 the coming together, carried in a dark velvet womb, accepting, floating from density into light. This is only the beginning, whatever that is. I like the others of no age, willing for once to wait, knowing in time only the exquisite balance of everywhere at once, saying, "You are here, come. You have no name that Emma fits." Who hears and answers the answers? Childness knows no blame, only the lightness of being. In your childness nothing will be lost, though all is right in the place of no sides at all, of return without going away. Know this, that time is life, enclave born to other enclaves. Every step of the weaning still heavy on my pillow, the joy is lifted with me. From even the light am I detached. It takes me in till Richard Wilbur's line, "Love calls me to the things of this world." It was real. It happened to me. But like that photograph, it took a long time to find out exactly what had happened. I went to sleep with the ineffable. I do every night. I sleep with it. I lie on my pillow, raise my scalp, physically open my crown, and see what's there waiting for me from my guides, my informers, all the things that get to happen. I'm running out of time. I wanted to tell you about how this has worked through the years, how it's been healing, fixing me, taking care of me, and I haven't time. Let me finish with one little rounding out of things. Emma Turner, my great-grandmother, I was named for, of course, and my grandmother, Emma Louise Stainer Richards. And then last year, on my birthday, we had our 19th grandchild, a new little Emma, born on that birthday. This little baby, this is the grandmother speaking, but she would lie on the changing table and look at a white wall. If ever there was a manifestation of where she had come from and what kinds of wonders she was trailing, this was it. There would lie this busy little 5-month-old baby, and she'd meditate. For half an hour at a time, Emma Grace lies looking at the white wall. All is there beyond her lying on the changing table, barely freed from being held by blankets wrapped just so, according to the nurse's best dry ways of mimicking the womb. Elfin hands butterfly the air, grasshopper legs untighten, stretch, pump a gentle paean to arrival. Eyes so mostly closed search out a somewhere, blinking in a stillness, still as supplicants desire but never quite attain. Minutes still the molecules of time in so short a life leave undisturbed her gaze. Her quiet folds her here into the there. A white wall must exude to eyes not even earthly hunger can coax, to any feasting but the pure recall that takes its time exchanging places in the unsterile air of leaving and arriving home. This great sense of being home has been a constant part of every kind of experience that I've had out of the night since the accident. I end the book with an epilogue, and I'm going to end with a playing of this hymn in 1 minute. The epilogue to the book. I found, by the way, along the way, that this sense of this reverence for the holy can be transferable. I found in a cathedral in Galway, Ireland, sitting next to a friend who she could raise her scalp at that moment. And we listened to Danny Boy. I said, "That's my song. I learned it on the piano from my father when I was 10. And in this cathedral, there was nobody making the music. It was just music in Gaelic. And, of course, I knew every word right to the end of, "And if you come and maybe find me dying or even dead, as dead I well may be, you'll come and find where I am lying and kneel and say an ave there for me. And I shall hear, though soft you tread above me, all my grave will warmer, sweeter be. And you will kneel and whisper that you love me, and I will sleep in peace until you come to me. I sat there with tears rolling down this very shirt. Couldn't say a word. Sat there engulfed in a re-entry into my death experience. With all the people, all my dears there, the essences of no age that were there, all speaking to me. And when I finally came to, I said to my friend, "Where did the music come from?" And she'd heard it too, which I was grateful for. And there was no sign of where the music could possibly have come from. No choir, no PA system, and here it was, this secular song in a cathedral with the lights shining through stained glass windows and with white shining right on the crucifix and Jesus Christ. She felt it too and knew it and heard it too. And I thought, this is transferable. There's a possibility to be able to tell people about this and have it real. I called my Catholic friend in Tulsa when I got home and said, "Catherine, let me tell you what happened." And she said, "You heard the music of the spheres, which we talk about, but very few ever get to experience." She says, "You were resting in the spirit." Well, I came back thoroughly sold again on the notion that there are all kinds of possibilities. And the return home is very real. And always there. And this is the epilogue to my book, which I'll read just part of. It's the 139th Psalm. O Lord, thou hast searched me and known me. Thou knowest my downsitting and my uprising. Thou understandest my thoughts afar off. Thou compassest my path and my lying down, and art acquainted with all my ways. For as there is not a word in my tongue, but lo, O Lord, thou knowest it altogether. Thou hast beset me behind and before, and laid thy hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain unto it. And then at the end, I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. And the hymn that I'd written in a time of direst need when one of our daughters was extremely ill. I was on the general board of the Young Women's Mutual Association, and we needed a hymn to close the meeting that Jolene Meredith and I had written other music for. I said, "I'll call you back." I went to my desk and then the basement room, and I wrote the three verses to "Where Can I Turn for Peace in Great Anguish." I called Jolene, and she had a history of mental illness in her family. She understood well that anguish. She sat at her piano, and I read a line, and she wrote a line. In less than an hour, we had our hymn. I have every conviction that this is my testimony of how it works and where I get to turn for peace and what can happen for any of us if we trust that night. Whatever the night provides. My mother's thing, pray at night, plan in the morning, is a very workable solution for me to everything I ever need. So this is a recording that the Tabernacle Choir did. You want to push that? On their last CD. And I thought that this would be appropriate too. It's been translated into many languages. It's been sung by all kinds of groups and choruses on CDs and tapes. And the reason it has, I know, is that all of us have our Gethsemanes. We all go along and think, where can I turn for peace? And for me, this is where I turn. And this is how it works. I say this to you in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.